Good morning. Good to see ya. Felt so good to be here. I've been away quite a bit lately, and then I got back and I'm able to just come here and sit in this room with people and have bodies together and be quiet and be still and see what's coming up. And that is so precious to me. So I'm glad to have the opportunity. We're going to have a change of pace now because now I'm just going to talk a lot. My talk today is titled Three Natures, Teachings for Power, Compassion, and Liberation. So the Three Natures is one of the main teachings of the Yogacara school, which is about a 1,500-year-old Buddhist tradition that's very influential and kind of influences a lot of other Buddhist traditions. So I'm just going to let you know that the Three Natures is not it's not an easy-to-get teaching. So if you're really new, you might be like, whoa, this talk is crazy. That might happen. Actually, if you've been here a long time, the same thing might happen. So, you know, generally speaking, when giving talks here at the Zen Center or at Zen Centers anywhere, when I'm traveling, you know, I can really expect to see there'll be someone there who's never been to a place like this before, and then there'll be someone who's been practicing for way longer than me. And somehow we just try and be together in a way that will support everybody. But some of the teachings are going to be a little bit more challenging and some less so. So this Three Natures teaching is really cool because it's intellectually challenging, but if you start to get it intellectually, that's when it really starts to be challenging. Because what is it intending to do is really radically challenge at the root of your experience what reality is. And this is not uncommon in Buddhist teachings. This is not uncommon. Because at the heart of a lot of Buddhist thought is that we are just stuck. Human beings are stuck in patterns of harm. We're stuck in patterns of harm, and we can break those patterns of harm. That's kind of the underlying idea. And I'm pretty sure that if you turn on the news, you might be like, I think we might be stuck in patterns of harm. You might be able to perceive that. And you might not have to turn on the news. You might just be able to take a few steps and feel the condition of your own heart or see what your mind is doing and be aware that we can be stuck. But we can be free. And that is the basic principle underlying what we're doing here. So the three natures are things that are inherent in anything that you think exists. So I'm going to describe these three natures. They're natures that all the things that you think are real already have. First nature is the imaginary nature. So everything that you think is real or exists is of an imaginary nature. It's being imagined. And that may already seem kind of weird, because you might think, no, it's real stuff. But what I'm going to give you this way of looking at things is that it's being imagined. And then you might be like, wow, well, are you just saying I'm imagining everything? It's all up in my head? And the answer is no, because your head is imaginary. You are currently probably imagining that you have a head that's separate from the universe. And not only that, it can't be you imagining it because the you that you think is separate from the universe is of an imaginary nature. And then all the other things we might think of as being external phenomenon, or it might have a mediated relationship. Like sometimes we think our body is ours, and sometimes we think it's us. So there are some things that are kind of, we change whether we view it's us or not us. But regardless, all of it is imaginary. And so then you might think, no, I don't like this teaching. This is telling me nothing matters. Go away. Time to tune out. And this is where this is really radical. Because the whole point of saying that everything has imaginary nature is to remind you that you have power. That you have power. Because the central thesis of a lot of Buddhist teaching is that we experience a world that is created by the conditioned habits of our mind and our heart, our emotions and our thoughts. That's called karma. So that's what we experience as reality. And we are always participants in the creation of that mental and emotional conditioning. That is to say, of our karma, which means we are always have power to make a contribution to how we will imagine, that is to say, experience the world. We always have power. So that everything you think exists has imaginary nature. Wonderful. Everything has dependent nature. Dependent nature is that anything that you think is separate is dependent on infinite other conditions. So one way to think about it is just pick something out of your experience right now. Let's take, do you have any physical sensations in your left big toe? We'll just detect that. And then just take a minute, start listing things which have to happen for you to have that sensation. So you can make up your own. We could say neurons. We could say consciousness. We could say atoms. There has to be H2O. There has to be... those are ways of thinking about it. But anyway, and we could say, well, there had to be... Someone had to give birth to me, or I wouldn't have this sensation. Someone had to give birth to her. And so on. And we could just do this, and so you, if you decided, I'm going to list all the things on which this sensation in my left big toe depends, you could, till the end of your life, list things and never get close. Never even get close to listing all the things. In fact, if you were somehow granted eternal life, you could list things on which that big toe depends for that non-existent ever and never get to the end. And this is true not just for this little sensation that we think is so unimportant, but for everything within the field of experience at any time. So your sense of you being separate from other things, your sense of that there are little variations in the texture of the wall, little bumps. Every one of those bumps, infinite dependencies. Then we have the complete realized nature. So everything's totally dependent on everything else. Everything is imaginary or has imaginary nature. Both these things are true. And everything is complete realized nature. Hey, guess what that? That's Buddha. Too late. If you want to wait to become a Buddha, it's too late. Realization is inherent here. So complete, realize, complete implies that it is whole, and realize means that it's real. But this is what's really strange about this teaching. Well, there's a lot of things that are strange. I'll admit, is that the basic quality of realness is that things are not independent things. Because they're imaginary, they're not real. And because they're dependent, they're not separate things. So anytime you think a thing is a separate thing, you're not seeing that it's whole and it's real. You're seeing something other than realization. And this may seem very strange, but here's the basic thing. Once you realize that there are no things, you can't control anything. You're free. You're free. There's no way for anything to be bound because there's nothing that controls anything else. There's no things that can be controlled, either you nor external to you. Total freedom. So the basic distinction that I'm making here is, I would say, somewhat semantic between power and control. You have power, but there's nothing that can be controlled. And power means you have agency and you could do something liberative and freeing and healing for the world. And control means that you don't really know how it's all going to work out. And in my experience, that's really pretty evident. So I will elaborate on these teachings a little bit and see if maybe we can find something that is freeing and enables us to recognize our capacity to be freeing. So the imaginary nature, Beck says, so whatever we think is real is of an imaginary nature. It's a construction of mental habit. You have ways of viewing the world conditioned by your thoughts, language, culture, your body, your emotions that produce the image that you think is an actual real thing. So just to be clear, when we say imaginary in a lot of Yogacara teachings, people think it becomes very mental, but your body is very much a part of your experience and conditioning your experience, the bodily sensations that you have here, which is why so much of our practice is centered on knowing what the body is manifesting. But guess what? It's still of an imaginary nature. So this is like, you know, kind of, it may inspire some doubt in you. You might be like, I'm not sure that's true. So one way to look at this, if you talk to neuroscientists and talk about the process from the materialist perspective, materialist being like believing that matter is ultimately real and that consciousness comes from that matter, they'll be like, yeah, definitely, we don't know what's real. I mean, a whole bunch of stuff is coming through this vastly mediated system in the brain, and then we get an image of reality. And then we just believe, this is ultimately real. But I'm not using a materialist neuroscientist perspective for one reason. I don't know much about it. So I'm going to talk more experientially. So, like, I was just recently had an awesome, literally awesome experience being in the mountains on retreat with a number of people who are here in this room. I lead retreats where we go into the wilderness, we practice meditation, we practice silence, we practice radical commitment to the vow to liberate all beings, and we just see what happens. And it's pretty various. So we have check-ins at the end of the day. We sit in a circle, and you know, we've been quiet all day, hopefully. And then it's like, well, what? How was it? And you know, someone will be like, wow. You know, I was just walking, and it was just like, it was just bird song and breath after breath. And then that waterfall. And I loved the waterfall, but I didn't even need to stay there. I was just able to just see it and move on. And then the next person says, my feet hurt. And it was just, ouch, 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 ouch. And then my feet hurt, and they still hurt. And then we walked through all this recently. We walked through a lot of burned forest fire areas of all different degrees. Some were 20 years old. Some were 2 years old. So extraordinary, you know, blackened stumps, blackened ground, wildflowers everywhere. And someone was like, oh, all day it was just, my heart was just broken and I saw the death and I was aware of the transience of things in my own life and I felt the pain of it and it was vivid. I got close to that. And someone else was like, wow, did you see all the purple flowers? So we were all in the same place doing the same thing. And yet the experience was so profoundly different. The distinction gets even more absurd when you're here for Sesshin and it's like all you do is look at a wall. And then you go up to the teacher and you're like, ah! All different things. The mind. It's not even just the mind. It's the universe is producing an imagination. Boom. Like this. How about the consciousness of my neighbor's dog, Coco? This is a fascinating phenomenon. So Coco is one of the cutest entities in the universe. And so Coco, you know, just manifests liberating cuteness throughout space and time. And it's great. Coco also loves to bark. Coco is an avid barker. And Coco likes to hang out in the yard next to mine some of the time. And so if I go into my backyard when Coco is in Coco's backyard, then this will happen. And Coco will just pursue me along the fence and I'll be like hanging my clothes on the line and the whole thing. And finally, my neighbor Amy, who's just wonderful, will be like, ah, Coco, come on inside. So, yeah, it's fine. But anyway, so Every time I do not enter my backyard when Coco's the backyard and is not. Wow. But here's the amazing. So I just point out, I am a very frightening and dangerous entity that should be viewed as a something to be defended against. But here's the thing, is if I walk to the end of the fence and I open the gate and I step 1 foot inside the gate, Coco will run up to me and roll over on her back and be like, good to see you. She'll want to climb on me. She'll lick me. What is that? What is the complete difference in what is being perceived by that dog when I cross literally 1 foot of an entirely arbitrary barrier? I like to think about other people's worldviews relative to mine to help me see how we are imagining something very different. When I was in, I came to spiritual practice through recovery from addiction. I'm a recovering drug addict and alcoholic. And so that my path of recovery started with spiritual development in groups. And there'd be people in there, they'd be like, well, I just know God is taking care of everything. And I just, everything's fine. I don't have to worry about anything because it's all in His hands. And I'd be like, I want that really bad. And I prayed daily for years, and I never got that thing. It never happened. But what is it like to, what does the world look like through that imagination? Which, by the way, is not like, oh, they're imagining God and I'm imagining something more real. No. Imagination. That's what I got. On the other hand, I also love to think about the way the world appears to people in many indigenous cultures and spiritual traditions. The world is inhabited by countless beings. So animals and plants have personalities and lives and souls, and these are this is the community that you live in. What is that like to experience the world in that way? I don't know. But the way that we are imagining the world really matters. And the way I'll invite you to think about that is think about the condition of the natural environment for animals, plants, trees, minerals in North America for the 13,000 years that it was occupied by the indigenous people of this land relative to the condition of the animals, plants, and minerals of this continent since the colonization by European Americans who bring a worldview where the world is not imbued with life in this way. So, the way we imagine the world really matters. So, if I say that, you know, say, oh, people will use, they say, oh, it's just in your head, as if that diminishes the importance. But actually, in Buddhism, that actually amplifies the importance. Because that's what you're experiencing. The fact that it's imaginary affirms that you are experiencing something distinct and it's going to have impact. And then the basic underlying tenet of Buddhist psychology is that you can transform this imagination. So all of us will find those places where someone else is just stupid and wrong and all we got to do is get rid of them and then everything will be great. Or some part of our personality is just terrible and flawed and all we have to do is get rid of it. And then everything will be great. We're like this. But we can begin to... That's an imagination. We're imagining the world to be that way. And we can begin to condition the mind to imagine the world in a way where we just know we can meet things with compassion and with the spirit of liberation and healing. So that if a difficult feeling comes up, if anger or despair or shame comes up, we can go, oh, I can meet this. And then what is contributed to your imagination is the tendency to know you have the capacity to do something healing. We can change the fundamental way we perceive our experience in the world. So this is power. This, I would argue, is the most fundamental and real power human beings have, is to make this little contribution to how the world is imagined. So, I want to give you just a little poem here about a woman who had some realization of this. So this is a poem by Miao Zhang, who is a 13th century Chinese Buddhist nun. Miao Zhang wrote, "In the shade of two trees and the hanging green of the cliffs, one lamp for 1,000 years broke open the dark barriers. I, too, now realize that phenomena are nothing but a magic show and happily grow old among the mists, the rivers, and the stones. In the shade of two trees and the hanging green of the cliffs, one lamp for 1,000 years broke open the dark barriers. I, too, now realize that phenomena are nothing but a magic show and happily grow old among the mists, the rivers, and the stones." So Miao Zhang chose to put herself somewhere where she should slow down, sense her environment, shine the lamp of her awareness, and crack through thousands of years of conditioning and see that it's imaginary. And then it's not like, it doesn't matter, whatever. I'm going to happily grow old right here amidst the conditions of my life. This is possible for you. So, imaginary nature is right here. The dependent nature. Dependent nature, as I was saying before, you know, if we try and list things on which things are dependent, we can go forever. Realizing this is an antidote to the tendency to want to control things. So once we start to realize that everything's interdependent, we realize that anything we thought we've controlled, there's always some other thing left out of our picture of what has happened. So, like, I would say the Western cultural mindset is really radically focused on external material control. This comes right from the root of early early philosophy. We're going to look at stuff and be like, that's out there. Let's figure out what it is. And then we can do stuff with it. It's going to be great. And it's pretty cool. I mean, it's like, they put human beings on the moon. Wow. I mean, you don't do that. You know, actually, I could go to the moon with my imagination. That's so much easier. So much easier. And there's more cheese. Anyway, it's pretty incredible what this tendency to objectify and try and control things can do. Put people on the moon. But I hope you all do a little listening to Gil Scott-Heron. Because Gil Scott-Heron has a really good song where every line starts out, he's talking about something really awful happening in the United States, usually around race, oppression, radical unfairness. And then at every line he says, "And Whitey's on the moon." And Whitey's on the moon. Because when we focus on control, so much is always left out. So much is always left out. And instead we can begin to have a holistic view. And instead of trying to control things, we can recognize that we are contributing in some ineffable way. This is where our power is, into the whole, into that conditioning, this vast dependency. Because since everything has dependent nature, everything depends on it. The whole universe depends on the choice you make. No pressure. Just another way of framing or looking at how the illusion of control is very common like, you know, I used to have little kids, and it's like, sometimes you just want to be like, stop! I am in charge. Now I am controlling you. You'll often hear, why? You control my kids. And in countless cultures, whether it's accepted or not, people use violence to control children's behavior. And it's been demonstrated that it works. If a child is doing something that you don't want to do right now, it's well documented, you can use violence and you can get them to stop doing what you want them to. Threatening violence or actually using violence, verbal violence, these methods actually are effective at controlling behavior. But it's also well documented that if you track the life of people who have been have this method used for controlling their behavior, you will see that they have more depression, anxiety, and anger problems in their lives. You will see that they have lower educational outcomes and cognitive capacities. You will see that they have problems with their relationships throughout their lives. And their economic conditions will not be as good as people who are not subjected to violence when they're children. So the thing is, it looks like you're controlling something. But we never know the end of the effects of anything that we do. This is part of the genius of nonviolent social movements, is recognizing that whatever you put into the world in an affective sense, that is to say, what is the emotional energy you're putting into the world, is actually what is being reproduced. So that you can put nonviolence into the world, and what will be reproduced is actually nonviolence. But if you meet the same condition with violence, what will be produced is violence. This is the central tenet of Buddhist karma theory. And this, I think, certainly relates to Dr. King's frequent use of Martin Luther King's frequent reference to our being involved in an inescapable network of mutuality, being tied in a single garment of destiny. Whatever affects one directly affects all indirectly, and so on. Just recognizing that we have power. I mean, there's definitely someone who believed people had power. So we got our imaginary nature. That's what most of us, that would be described as like what we think is real. We're usually not seeing the dependent nature, but we can. We can learn to see it. If you sit and practice meditation, especially Zazen, the tendency of your mind to divide everything up just settles a little bit. And you tend to just, people tend to just sense this. So you don't have to have someone explain it to you in such bizarre terms, and you just know it in your heart. So anyway, we have the imaginary nature, the dependent nature, and the complete realized nature. So everything that you think is real already has complete realized nature. It's whole, it's part of the completeness of the entirety of whatever is, and it's real. It's being realized by you, because no one else can be experiencing what you're experiencing right now but you. Oh, wow. So you're realizing the completeness of the universe, but it seems possible that you are not noticing it. Not sure. Seems possible. Me too. So we miss this. This is something that we often miss. So anyway, it's pretty cool. Like, enlightenment is right here. That includes that you that you think is separate from everything else is still enlightenment. Wow. Wonderful. But you can't get it. You can't have it. Too bad. So in the 30 verses on consciousness only of Vasubandhu, which is one of the kind of one of the best explanations of this teaching, he defines the complete realized nature. He says the complete realized nature is no self nature. Let us say it's not a thing. So the fundamental thing that anything you think a thing is that it's not a thing. It's not my fault. I didn't make this tradition up. I may be explaining it worse or better than someone else, but I'm doing my best. The fundamental thing, the fundamental quality, the realization quality of everything that you think is a thing that's separate from other things is that it's not a thing. You're like, well, who cares? Blah, blah, blah. That means you can't control it. And it can't control you. You are already completely free from any kind of control. From being able to control or be controlled. And we just don't know that. Doesn't mean that our imagination that is full of all these feelings of controlling and being controlled doesn't matter. It doesn't seem very real to us. But ultimately, because everything is totally interdependent, they're not separate things that are controllable. You're already free, and everything is already liberated. So then, because the complete realized nature is a little paradoxical, gotta say, then Vasubandhu goes on to describe it as thusness. Thusness. So thusness, sometimes they say suchness, as it isness, things as it is. This means the complete realized nature is just whatever's happening here. Whatever's happening here, really, like, it's not like there's some non-thingness of this thing I think is a thing. It's really my whole experience is immediately liberation. Not, it's a ground where I can enact liberation because it's imaginary, and it's already liberation because it's ungraspable. And we think, oh, grasp it. So we get a little stuck. But we don't have to. We can realize freedom from this sense. And if you start to look at your life, you'll see how much you want to make things. You know, not even you want to. You tend to make things. Your consciousness produces things which appear like controllable entities. And that is so frustrating. That's so frustrating. Why don't you ever do the dishes? Why don't I stop having these terrible feelings? Why do I have these hateful thoughts in my mind? Why are those terrible people doing all that bad stuff that I'm better than? Whatever. Oh, it's exhausting. And if you really care, I hope you really care. If you think you can get control, it's going to be super frustrating. The conditions of the world with all this suffering, it's big. It's not going away. You think, yeah, 16 months, we'll get rid of that one guy, everything will be great. I don't think so. It was hard for people before, and it will be hard for people after. And we have power. So the basic idea here is to realize that because everything is already complete realized nature, we're totally free from control. That is to say, free from needing or being able to control anything, and from being controlled. Maybe you just say this. Here's an example, because you think, what? Come on, man. So you can never expect anyone to be this amazing, but there's nothing wrong with being amazed. Let's consider Nelson Mandela. Imprisoned for years in a tiny cell in conditions of staggering injustice. And you can read his writings. He's like, I'm free. I realize freedom here. And I can manifest that for everyone else. This is a human capacity. It's not just some weird idea. Anyway, so because things are complete realized nature, we're free from control. Because everything is interdependent, everything you do really matters. Because it is imaginary, the most powerful thing you can do and the ground of your power is to focus on transforming the affective and cognitive tendencies of your mind so that you're realizing liberation here. So putting love into the world, putting compassion into the world, meeting each thing with that will condition the mind to be able to meet it with that more. Realizing connection where you see alienation, this will transform experience, and your experience is always tied to everyone else's. Well, thank you very much for your kind attention. And I now invite other voices, questions, stories, anything. Yeah.
Ben, I would like to suggest that Coco is not angry because you're big and scary and need to be defended against, but because you would dare do something other than rub her tummy.
Oh! I will investigate. Thank you. Thank you.
In my day-to-day life, I talk to people about managing stress. I help them set goals around managing stress.
Mm.
And typically how the conversation starts is I ask, you know, what's your hope around our conversations around managing stress? You know, what do you hope to do differently? And, like, most of the time people say, I want to learn how to control my stress.
Mm-hmm.
So the talk just really resonates with this need to, like, really differentiate what I have control over, what I don't. But we really innately think that controlling it's the answer.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, that talk was just very real and helpful.
Thank you. Yeah, and, you know, Buddhist rhetoric is designed to challenge us. I mean, I think science is great. I'll be like, I am cleaning this because I want it to be clean. You know, so it's not like we need to throw the idea of control out the window. But to do things that really radically challenge our conditioned ways of thinking can be so helpful. And so, yeah, it's sad to see how much people want to control them. The conditions of themselves. Yeah, I'm sure you see a lot of that. Yeah, go ahead.
There was a section of your talk where you kind of listed through some thoughts, like, look at the actions of these other people that are so harmful, and what about, like, these injustices? And I was really hoping that at the end of that list you'd have, like, the one-liner, and here's how to resolve our emotional, psychological, you know, when these things pop up.
Yeah, the one true answer. I do not have that. There's so many things we can do, and different people have different capacities and ways of meeting people. So yeah, I just want to. This is like not a clear like answer, but I was hanging out. I just bring it up because it's moving and I want to talk about it. I was at the annual boat cruise for the Islamic Resource Group yesterday, and with some colleagues of mine, and IRG, what they do is they just travel around and talk to people about Islam. They're Muslim people. They talk about Islam and what it's like to be Muslim. And it's really cool. And a lot of people are like, it's wonderful to learn. And then there are other people, like my friend John, he says, yeah, I have people I know who follow me around the state to harass me. And, you know, people will just come and yell at them. How can you be in this church, you infidels, and so forth. So they're subjected to some really intense hatred. And I would go back and say, you can't expect anyone to do this, but you can be inspired and amazed when people do. They don't complain about it. They're just like, I just keep showing up because people need to know. And if we keep having conversations and meeting people, it will change. And we've seen it change. So they just show how going into those situations, what does Desmond Tutu say? If you want peace, don't talk to your friends, talk to your enemies. So meeting people, if you have the strength to do it, if it's too activating, then maybe that's someone else's job and there's someone else to do. But everything is an encounter. So the same thing is true of your own emotional reaction. So once you're like, don't make yourself an enemy. Move closer. Move closer with compassion.
It struck me when you were talking then that power and control are something that terms that we use in the feminist movement at least, and have been more I think kind of acknowledged in the world in the last couple of years as defined with a male identity.
Mm.
And I just think about power and in the use of violence to keep power and control over things. Mm. Defined as fully human, you know, people of color and women. And I just wonder, as we hopefully are approaching a world where the feminine is more of a force, that this won't be so hard for us.
Yeah, great observation. I just like to look, how many feminist wars have you guys noticed? Feminist bombings? Feminist shootings? Not very many. So it may be that someone is showing a pretty good way to do this. There's a lot to be learned. So thank you. Yes, I think so. Go ahead, Jason. Yeah.
Just share some wording that caught my ear. You're saying that if you're waiting to become like the Buddha, too late. This brought me way back to my first flying out for my first interview in North Carolina, sitting next to this evangelical Christian, and I was fresh off of Religions of the World class, and I was challenging them, back and forth, and we even got to dinosaurs, and he's listening, letting me do my challenging, and then as we're landing and about to get our bags off, he's like finger wagging, like, "Don't debate until it's too late." Different message here.
Yeah. Yeah, debate has its place, but just hearing people is really good. I think 8% debate, 4, it's probably enough. Anyone else? Yeah.
Can you talk a little bit about the power and control with like your own meditation practice?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So that we get, it's kind of like there's a little bit of a paradox in the teaching, right? Because, we do something. It's like, you got to come to the cushion and sit down. But Zazen is pretty radically, in particular, like some modes of meditation have more of an active, they use the controlling. You're like, I'm going to get this stuff to happen. Zazen is like one of the most radical attempts to not do that. To use your power to actually surrender control completely. So that that the universe can arise, it just shows up as it is. And normally, my mind wants to like figure something out about it. And so you need to have some energy for the practice. Right? Or otherwise, you'd maybe just sit and space out. So your power is to contribute to the tendency of your mind to let go of control by just continually opening to the whole field of experience. If the mind is too busy, we might actually need to throughout Buddhists, we have a lot of homeopathic treatments. We treat a problem with the thing that causes the problem. So we're going to have to use the tendency of our mind to want to control and go, oh, let's come to the breath. Let's come to the breath. Because that's just necessary right now. So sometimes it really helps to have a holder. And we kind of tap into that sense that there's control. And that can help us to settle the mind on some phenomena and to begin to imagine a world where we can be stable and be with our bodies. And then maybe at some points we become settled enough that we can let go of even that. And then our power is giving up everything. Does that seem like a reasonable, or do you have any more you want to go with that? Because that's rich.
Yeah, I think even bringing focus to the breath, there can be like a difference of approaching that with power and control.
Mm.
Be like
I think that said it perfectly.
Yeah. So it's really good. It's the affect the affect is what we're putting in the world, ultimately. Affect, like emotional energy. So is it this kind of grabbing, gotta get it, or is it this relaxing and opening? And just knowing those, that's what we're trying to really know. That's to say, be aware of. And without controlling it, just be like, oh, look at that. That was hot. If you try and control it, then you just roll into the same system. But you might be able to just be like, oh, I'm getting a little tight. I know that too. This too. This too. Okay. I think that should be complete for Dharma Talk and questions. Thank you all very much.